Brian, how did you even start to think about who was going to do your beverage manufacturing?
It was putting together a jigsaw puzzle and not having a picture to look at while you're doing it. Hello, everyone. You're listening to Making Maca, a podcast about a startup beverage journey into launching and scaling a CPG brand. I'm Brian Hill.
And I'm Russell Hirshon.
And we are your hosts.
In this episode, we'll be talking about the pros and cons of various food and beverage manufacturing approaches and why Maca settled on co-manufacturing.
Something I want to clarify here, there's a difference between processing and manufacturing, and sometimes that gets used interchangeably. For our purposes, processing is typically when you take raw materials and you're turning those into ingredients. So we're going to be focusing on manufacturing, and that's taking those ingredients from those processors and creating a consumable product. Now, to do that, there's a few different avenues to manufacture. The four main ones are home-based manufacturing, storefront manufacturing, so essentially just doing it in a facility, your own facility. There's shared kitchen / commissary manufacturing. And then commonly there's the contract manufacturing, also goes by the name co-man, co-production. We use those terms interchangeably here.
So explain self-manufacturing, the home and storefront being the same.
The advantages of this particular method is fairly low cost of entry initially when you're talking about home. You have ownership of the entire process when you're producing in your kitchen. It's great for proprietary processing methods, like if you're talking about Beyond Meat, like when it first started, that was definitely proprietary, how to produce that product. If you need to control production timing, like you don't have someone telling you that they don't have line time available, so you just produce whenever you're ready and wanting. One thing that's overlooked is you actually have easier access to financing. There's SBA loan programs that are geared towards manufacturing facilities. It's hard to raise money for particularly debt financing for like a co-manufacturing endeavor, but it's easier if you're building your own facility because there's a physical product that the bank can loan against. In this case, real estate. There's some big disadvantages to it though. And we talked about real estate. You're either going to have to lease, you're going to have to use your own space in your house potentially, or maybe you even go out and you buy a facility, but you have leasing and real estate expenses that you need to consider. Equipment, appliances, very expensive. Again, you can use SBA loans and other debt instruments to obtain them, but very expensive. Particular maintenance of those. Scalability. If you're doing this in your home, you only have so much space. Even if you have your own facility, you're limited by the space of that facility. Like if you go gangbusters and you have a unicorn product, you're then having to figure out, okay, I have to upscale my real estate. You have licensing, FDA compliance. Those are big things to go through that process and not talk about expense. It's more time consuming. You might even need to have special food manufacturing training if you don't have it already. There's record keeping requirements. There's technical teams. Depending on what you're producing, you might need to have someone who specifically knows how to pasteurize or knows how to can. Whatever your method is, I would almost assume you're going to need to bring in a technical team. I'm blanking on the brand name, but there was a lawsuit recently where an owner of an alkaline water company was not familiar with proper dosing, and he put too much alkalining ingredient into his water and ended up killing someone. So these are real things. If you don't know how to do it, make sure you get someone that knows how to do it. You don't want that on your conscience. There's also your own line time. every minute that you are not using your facility, it's costing you money. So you might need to now go out and offer co-manufacturing services to other people just to keep your equipment in use and offset some of those costs. When you're using it, you're now abusing it potentially, which means there's definitely maintenance costs you need to consider. So these are all real sunk fixed costs that you have to consider going down this path.
That is that's a lot to think about. Many major metro areas have shared kitchens, also known as commissary kitchens. Did you look at this avenue?
Yeah. Where we are, there's actually a well-known one. Major brands have gone through them, and they've done a tremendous job. There's some good advantages to working with a commissary, and it's a low barrier to entry when it comes to costs. You're essentially leasing time to use equipment. So, and what's also great about that is it could be short term, could be long term if you want to have some cost savings, but you can go month to month. You could even rent by the hour depending on the commissary. The big advantage is there's little to no investment in equipment or appliances unless you're doing something so specialized they don't have that equipment and you're considering bringing it in. There's almost no expense when it comes to equipment. They can grow with you as your business scales up to a point. Like, you're limited by what the facility itself can do because unlikely they're going to expand just for your one business. So that there is a pro there that at least in the early stages, maybe up into the middle stages, they can scale with you. Another, a lot of people see this as an advantage, is there's no ownership responsibility, ownership in the sense of like having to manage the real estate, manage the maintenance of the equipment, all that other stuff. Licensing is largely covered by the commissary. You still have to do, depending on your jurisdiction, you still have to have some licensing in place. Where we are, you have to get a shared kitchen license as well as a catering license if you wanted to participate in a commissary. So it just depends on where you are, what the rules and regulations are. Another advantage is you have access to staffing, potentially some support. You're going to have to pay for the support, but some of the commissaries even have educational series. You're surrounded by, and this is a great thing to have, you're surrounded by other entrepreneurial brands and people. So you have a community that's built in.
What are the disadvantages?
There's many as well. And it's not an easy decision if you're going to go down this way, because some of the disadvantages are significant. Your access is restricted to whatever hours your agreement specifies. There might be overflow hours that you can purchase, but you have to purchase it. It's not like you just have free reign when you're in these spaces. It's shared space. There's no privacy, typically. It's a large open area. There's many work tables. So what that means is if you have a proprietary manufacturing process, this probably isn't the avenue for you. Even if you have a uniquely differentiated product that you don't want competitors in the market yet, this might not be the place for you. So something to really consider there. Costs can add up quickly if you need to buy additional time, because now you had this major order and you need to produce something really quick. Otherwise, you could potentially lose the account. That's going to cost you money to get that extra time. You might need to purchase extra support. You might need storage, overflow space. All these things add up. And so whatever fees are being proposed to you, again, my theory is always double it, because you just don't know what might come up. And then other things to look out for is some commissaries require, or they highly recommend, that you participate in their accelerator. Whether that accelerator is going to be useful or impactful to you is for you to decide. But sometimes there is pressure to participate in accelerator. Accelerator or not, some commissaries will require equity in your company. Still charge you for space, access, distribution, other things. Those are all things to look at. The last one, equity, to me, is a red flag. I wouldn't be giving up equity for kitchen space.
So after all that, Imaka ultimately settled on contract manufacturing. What are those pros and cons?
Largely, every disadvantage that you heard before is a pro here. So, like, you don't have real estate expenses, no leasing expenses. There's no required investment in equipment, appliances. Licensing is very minimal. No staffing requirements. You're essentially outsourcing staffing. So that means your own operations can remain very lean. And to me, that was very attractive, largely why we chose this path. There's also a lot of compliance, licensing, certifications, good manufacturing processes and practices that the co-man is responsible for. Takes all that burden off of you as a brand. It's highly scalable, assuming you have the right co-manufacturer. So you can start with your minimum run, and then you can go all the way up into millions of units per run if you have the right co-man. You can expand into other territories. So you're not restricted to where you are to produce. There's some companies that have built their own facilities. And let's say for this example, they're on a coast, but now you find that most of your customer base is on the other coast. So now you have those shipping costs that you have to think about, freight costs. What's great about co-manufacturers is you can open up a bunch of them throughout the country, very little expense. Certifications, they all run through the facility. That's big because there's a real cost to having a facility certified, and it's usually an annual review that's in the thousands. If you have multiple certifications, that adds up real quick, and it's a tremendous headache having to manage these reviews. So again, that's off the table. You don't need to do that. And then a co-man could be a tremendous resource. They can connect you with ingredient suppliers, with distributors, with retailers. Some of them even have marketing services that they can provide to you to get your name out. So there's some real advantages to using a co-manufacturer.
And disadvantages?
On the flip side, you really have to weigh the disadvantages because it's loss of control. You are highly reliant on the co-manufacturing team. It's not you having your hands in every aspect of the creation of this product anymore. So you have to have complete faith and trust in them. Typically, a co-manufacturer does not have ownership in your brand. So there could be misalignment when it comes to expected quality, reliability, all those issues. It can be cost prohibitive for new brands to use a co-manufacturer. There's minimum runs that you're going to come up against. And depending on who you're talking with, they could be in the hundreds of thousands of units per SKU, meaning per flavor. So that's something you need to weigh. There are co-manufacturers that will do smaller runs, but there's fewer and fewer of them. That's a big con, just the expense of it. Small runs, if you can find them, are going to be expensive initially. You have to make sure you have the margin to withstand that. Once you start scaling up, that's when you really start realizing the benefits of the economy of scale, where your unit costs come way down. But initially, a small run is going to be expensive. You have minimal control over your line time and its availability. You're, as a small brand, you're kind of at the whim of the co-manufacturer and when they want to give you line time. Big brands will always take precedence here. Someone producing 4 million units in a run is definitely going to take over someone that's doing 10,000 units in a run. Another thing to consider is that you're sharing your formulas and recipes. Of course, a good agreement protects you. It's still nerve-wracking, though. There's IP risk here. Even with the best intentions and even with the best agreements, if there's someone that has nefarious ideas about your brand, they can take things that they shouldn't. So just something to consider. There's recourse, of course, but the damage could be done before recourse sets in. And then another thing to consider is storage of supplies prior to manufacturing, supplies and ingredients. coordinating the timing of the delivery of those, and then also where does that product go after? That's something you have to think through. It's not staying at the co-manufacturer, I can tell you that. So just think through those things. That's another additional cost that gets lost sometimes. You're highly reliant on the co-manufacturer's team, their management style, the project manager that is assigned to your account, for good or for bad. And sometimes it can be for bad.
So that was certainly a lot of information. That gives us an opportunity for a quick word from our sponsor. And that just happens to be us at this time.
Our mission here at Maka is wheatgrass for all, one can at a time. Your first can is on us. Go to livingmaka.com/making, select your flavor of choice, and check out with the code MAKING2022. Enjoy your free can.
So we're back. Brian, how did you even start to think about and think through who was going to do your beverage manufacturing?
It was putting together a jigsaw puzzle and not having a picture to look at while you're doing it. There was very few resources available at the time, readily available. You have great resources now. I've mentioned them before. Startup CPG, phenomenal community where they put together a Slack channel. They've also put together different resources. You can go there and find co-manufacturing lists. If you can't find a list, you can just ask the community. Someone is likely to tell you where they co-man. So those are great resources that I didn't have. So what I did was a lot of driving around, calling around. I came across economic development in various states that were surrounding where we are, reached out to them. Some of them had them, some of them did it, but those that had lists of co-manufacturers in their state or region provided them, which was phenomenal, except they didn't provide any definition on what these co-mans produced, whether it was a food product, a beverage product, if it was beverage, whether it was carbonated, what type of filling machines they had, like could they handle a 12-ounce sleek can? So you have a lot of research to do, even if you obtain a list like that. I accidentally called a Pepsi bottler thinking that they would be able to bottle for me. The guy just laughed and he goes, "No, sorry, we're exclusively Pepsi. We don't do any aluminum cans." So that was a funny experience. Really what it came down to is it was several weeks of Google searching, finally came across a facility that was nearby and would provide a smaller than usual first run when it comes to minimums. So what I did is I went out and I visited the facility. I built rapport with the leadership team and the project manager that was going to be assigned to the account. We finally determined that they could handle our technical specs, which was important because we have wheatgrass in our drinks. So there's some filtering issues that we have to consider when it comes to co-manufacturing. You might have your own issues with your particular product. So just make sure the co-man can handle that. So then ultimately we ended up scheduling a production date. Unfortunately, it was delayed a few times. They picked up a big account, or I just wasn't ready at the time that they had availability. Finally, we came across a date that worked for everyone and we were gearing up to go. And then I got news that their facility was acquired. And I was like, oh, this is great, because I looked at the company that was acquiring them. They have multiple production facilities across the country. So I was like, that's great. I get East Coast, and when I'm ready, I have Central, West Coast, South, like it was all there. Until I saw the new contract that they provided, I gave it to my FDA attorney because I already had a bad feeling. And she quickly came back and said, unless they're willing to alter the language here, this is a no-go. So I pushed them a little bit. They're like, no, we're not changing any of the language. I said, well, can you at least add in a sentence that says you'll follow good manufacturing practices? They came back and said, no. So I was like, okay, what manufacturer is not willing to say that they're going to follow good manufacturing practices, GMP? Like, this is common. Like, this is, you have to follow it. So just to say that you aren't going to put that language in, you're telling me you don't care about the product, the brand. Big red flag, ran. Luckily, at that time, I found out that our formulator actually started their own production facility. We were able to migrate over and get that done.
How serendipitous. So the formulator activates production facility at a time when you're needing one. Was there any one thing that gave you the confidence to move forward with them?
I had about a year, if not longer, building rapport with them. I had faith in their formulation capabilities. So I was familiar with the team that ultimately moved over to the production facility to manage that. And I was feeling pretty confident with them. The only thing that concerned me was I had a delivery deadline because I had already gone out and obtained pre-orders from retailers, and I was not going to miss those deadlines. So unfortunately, I couldn't go out and visit the facility, which was, I wouldn't say a big mistake, but I do wish that I spent the time to go out there and just see what we were dealing with. Nice facility. Like, there was nothing wrong with the facility, but that's something that you as a brand owner should do. Don't do this in the dark. Their team was very engaging. Leadership was highly communicative with me. I felt confident that they were going to pull it off.
Nice. And so just summarizing the best practices when selecting a production facility.
Yeah, definitely tour the facility. That's a big one. You're going to be spending a lot of time with these people. You're putting your faith in them to execute. You want to see where it's being produced and just make sure that it's up to par with what you're expecting. I alluded to this earlier. Definitely spend time building rapport with leadership. Issues will arise, and you want to make sure that someone is willing to step in and step up and resolve it. Because sometimes your PM, your project manager, doesn't have the ability or capability to do it on their own. So you want to make sure that you can escalate real quick and get something done. Also, build rapport with your project manager. There is going to be someone that's going to be assigned to your productions. Don't make it adversarial. You want to be friendly. Make sure you're all on the same page with what the quality expectations are and all that other stuff. Ultimately, what that means is just be highly engaged. It's not a set it and forget it thing. You can't just give them the recipe and hope that it's going to come out right. But at the same time, you don't want to micromanage, because what you are doing is you are outsourcing this to the team because they're professionals and they have more knowledge when it comes to production than you do. If you find that you are constantly second guessing the professionals, look for another facility. Don't move forward. It might delay your production time, but it's worth it. You want to make sure you're with a team you trust. Definitely be on site. Definitely for the first one, but I would highly recommend being on site for all runs. There's a lot that can go on during a production run that if you're not on site, you won't be aware of, you won't know about. We had some issues where some things were altered and ultimately created a fantastic product, but it wasn't documented. And because of that, the next production run, we came into the same issue. It wasn't documented, so we didn't know what the resulting solution was, and we had to rethink that. So being on site means that they're more likely to check every box, and especially when it comes to documentation for things that are changed on the fly. When you're on site, though, you do not want to impact the co-man operations. You're just there to monitor. You're really there for quality control. So sample the batching before it goes into canning. Try it right off the line. Make sure that both before and after pasteurization, it's to your standards. But you certainly don't want to be directing the on-site team without going through your point of contact. That's key. Once you're a burden, they won't have you on-site anymore.
Yeah.
And being on-site is important. Also, I mentioned this a little earlier, but let's just reiterate it. You want to think through where your supplies are housed at the beginning and where your end product is ultimately going to be stored. There's freight costs associated with that. There's timing issues that you have to think about. Where and how is the product moving back and forth? Think through that before production starts. Another big thing to consider, and we learned this the hard way, some of your ingredients, they're going to be refrigerated maybe. They might be frozen. A lot of them are going to be ambient. Think about when the ingredients need to arrive and how much time, if they're frozen in particular, how much time they need to thaw before they can be used. We sent over product maybe 4 or 5 days before production. It was frozen, thinking that it was going to be ready. It wasn't enough time. It takes about a week for a drum of juice to thaw. So those are things to consider. You want to know all aspects of your ingredients and storage. Know your recipe and the steps it takes to produce your product. If you see on site something like it looks like some of the steps aren't happening or they're occurring out of order, you want to know that, particularly in the batching process, because it can really alter the end product. So you need to know your recipe, know the steps. And at the very end, you need to know what the PA letter is requiring for, in particular, pH and pasteurization time and temperature. Like that impacts your shelf stability. If your pH is too high, too low, if the time and temp wasn't accurate, you might not have a shelf stable product, meaning everything needs to get trashed. So just know those things, make sure the team knows them, and you'll have verification at the end when they do testing. There's only two more things I can think of. Involve your FDA attorney, have them review agreements. This is important. If I did not have the FDA attorney review the production agreement for the other facility, I could have ended up in a terrible situation, bad product, no recourse. So very important to get them involved early. And then, as I said earlier, be your own advocate. There was a proposal at one point when we were in production where they came up with a solution to expedite throughput of the cans through the canning machine. But by doing so, it absolutely would have impaired our end product. If we weren't on site, if we didn't advocate and we didn't say, take a firm stance, we would have had ultimately an inferior product to what we're producing at this point.
And I can say, Brian, that was a very stressful moment as we went through that.
Yeah.
And that was, that truly tested, I think, our nerves and demonstrated the fact that you wanted a product that was always exceptional, always the best it could possibly be. That was a great takeaway.
The only thing I want to add, Russ, and I think this is important. When you go the co-manufacturing route, there's a team. They're not your team, but there's still a team that's producing your product. Be kind to them. Be friendly with them. Engage with them. Thank them. Share your product with them. It could determine whether you have a good product or not at the end of the day. It's just be kind.
Yeah, right? I mean, if you come in being a banshee and demanding and yelling at them, I think they'll definitely treat you differently. They won't be as facilitating as certainly the people we've been working with.
What really resonated with me was a comment Seth Goldman said, Seth with Honesty, rest in peace, in his book, as well as a direct conversation that we had. And he highly recommended avoiding creating your own facility for all the reasons mentioned earlier. Expensive, you have to fill the line time, maintenance. It's not your core business as a brand, a beverage brand. Do you want to be in manufacturing or do you want to be in beverage branding? What ultimately drove the decision, though, was we found a co-manufacturer with low, reasonably affordable minimums. We also wanted to make sure that we could keep Maka's team lean with the specific goal of extending our runway. We also wanted the scalability advantages of working with a co-manufacturer. Our roadmap leads to a national presence, which means likely multiple production facilities. And then we also had the economies of scale advantages. So as we start producing more within each of these facilities, our unit economics just get better and better. That's what you get with co-manufacturing, and you don't get with the other avenues.
At this point, you now have several key figures and assumptions necessary for building a financial model. In our next episode, we'll talk about the difference between markup and margin, how they'll play into your financial model, which is key to your fundraising efforts.
That brings us to the end of this episode of Making Maka. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas about our episodes, please send an email to hello@makingmaka.com. If you like what you hear on Making Maka, please share the podcast with friends and family and review us on your preferred listening platform. On behalf of Maka, thank you for joining us on this journey.